This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarter Bin. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue from my comic book collection, which I will always select at random or sometimes based on the calendar. Any book from my comic book collection is eligible as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for it. Was the issue worth 25 cents? Was it a bargain at 25 cents? Or was it still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 162nd episode of the Quarter Bin Podcast, we are looking at The Ray, number 20, from DC Comics, cover dated January 1996. But first, a little feedback. I missed an email about the Tarzan issues we did a few episodes back, and here are some thoughts from International Hitman. Note to self, edit that out, or it could get ugly. Here are some thoughts from one of our friendliest and kindest listeners, Darren Sutherland. Hi, Professor Allen. I spent the day in the jungle of our backyard pressure washing the fence. So what better thing to do than listen to your excellent coverage of Tarzan the Warrior in episodes 158 and 159. I always enjoy our Edgar Rice Burroughs conversations, so listening to you cover this miniseries was a treat. As an ERB and Tarzan fan, as well as a Malibu Comics fan, I'm surprised to say I completely missed this series. So thanks for the great discussion. I have quite a long history with the Tarzan character. My father was a fan of the Johnny Weissmuller movies, so when I was a kid, those were watched whenever they were rerun on TV, usually on weekend matinees. I really like those movies because of the nostalgia of watching them with my father, but was even a bigger fan of the Ron Ely TV series, which depicts Tarzan after he's educated but chooses to return to his beloved jungle. Obviously, Darren, as you certainly know, that version or that take on the character is actually more closely aligned to the ERB novels than the me Tarzan, you Jane approach of the Weissmuller era. Perhaps that was because of Weissmuller's limitations as an actor, but I do think that that has sort of set the tone for what people expect from a Tarzan project. So when you get the educated upper crust English gentleman, that seems very disconnected, but is actually one of the bits of the original Tarzan canon that I really enjoyed. And of course, Darren met Ron Ely at NostalgiaCon about 10 years ago because Sutherland's. He continues by saying he remembers seeing the excellent Greystoke movie in cinema when it was new. I also liked quite a few things about the Tarzan The Epic Adventures TV series of the 90s that attempted to faithfully adapt elements of the original novels. It was a valiant effort, but didn't quite succeed fully. I also enjoy many things about the recent reboot film and wished it had led to a series of films. Based on that New Adventures or Epic Adventures TV show, Darren, that is currently on deep, deep cable as reruns, and I've yet to pull the trigger and start recording them, but I think I may give it a shot during the late winter, early spring, perhaps. Darren adds, I also loved reading Tarzan comics whenever I could find them while growing up, and have a nice hardcover collection of the comics that my father gave me back in the 1970s. Like you, I agree that the Joe Kubert Tarzan comics are amazing, and I coincidentally reread his entire run within the last couple of years, and of course I know that you and I have a fondness for Mike Grell's take on the character as well. Yes, we do. Thanks for the excellent coverage of this fun series on your show. It was a delight to listen today. Have a great day, my friend, Darren. Thank you, Darren. I appreciate those kind words and that very interesting feedback. And totally not an international assassin. Let's be honest. Ruth, on the other hand, we're not so sure about. And to continue the complete podcast host fail, I also missed a couple of comments from Billy D about the network's Veterans Day episodes, which included Captain Storm coverage here on episode 160. Hey, Prof, good episode, and thank you for recognizing Veterans Day. Seems to be a day that is losing steam as the decades pass, and I'm not quite sure why. Paying respect to those who are responsible for keeping our freedoms alive is incredibly important. Captain Storm is a character I've seen but never read, but I've always loved the covers. Keep up the good work. Manuel Carmona wrote in on the War Comics Month special. Manuel and his wife run the excellent charity effort Comics for Christmas. Excellent episode, Professor. I haven't read a ton of war books in my life, but from the ones I've read, my absolute favorite is a Sergeant Rock miniseries called The Prophecy, written and illustrated by the incomparable Joe Kubert. Highly recommend it. I agree, Manuel. I read that last year, I think. It is one of the few war books that is on the DC Universe app. Manuel said he's also read a few G.I. Joe comics. I actually had Lair Hama sign a book for me at a convention here in Virginia a few years back. I have to say, after listening to the episode, y'all made me want to read more war books. And since I'm already trying to collect any Joe Kubert book I can find, maybe I'll look for his war books a bit harder. Especially those Enemy Ace books I keep hearing about. Keep up the great work and talk to you soon. P.S. I wish you and your family and the entire Relatively Geeky family a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Thank you, Manuel. And to you and yours as well. And we heard from the creator of hashtag ReadWarComics, Sir Luke. Professor, wanted to thank you for your coverage of Captain Storm back on Quarterman 160. Most comic fans are, I'm assuming, more familiar with Storm from his appearances in The Losers rather than his solo book. Naval stories can be a hard sell compared to the more common Army and Marines counterparts or even Air Force. Other than doing stories of frogmen or SEALs, in a Navy story, there is an obvious requirement for a lot of hardware in the form of a variety of ships, which can either become too technical or too vague. Additionally, these ships are typically manned by many dozens or scores or even hundreds of sailors, as compared to the handful of men in an infantry platoon, for example, meaning that it can be hard to focus on a few specific characters. The Captain Storm stories I've read seem to take something of a personal approach, focusing more on individual sailors rather than the overall naval story. I did like how the bonus story you covered specifically dealt with the burden of command, which in the case of Storm is both similar and a bit different to how we would see this story beat play out in the pages of, say, Sergeant Rock. Definitely thought-provoking stuff. Unfortunately, I do not think DC has ever collected Captain Storm in either color or black and white, given the amount of war comics that they put in Showcase, black and white, phone book format. That is a disappointment. At least we have plenty of his stories over in our fighting forces with the other losers. Keep up the good work, Luke. Thank you, Luke. I think those are good insights on the differences between infantry versus the lone airman versus an entire ship full of sailors in terms of having a narrative focus for a story. Our buddy Chris Ouellette admitted that he has a hard time with war stories. I like the idea of Lord of the Rings type battles where you know who to root for. Anytime I've seen something like this, they still set it up as one side is good and the other side is evil, but my understanding of history is that with real war, it's very rarely like that. And Sir Luke replied to Chris, this was on the Facebook thread, many war comics fall into that, especially the pre-code books. I would say that most of the titles we discussed, especially the DC titles, are more nuanced than that. But obviously, not every comic will appeal to every reader. Exactly, Luke. I agree with that. Taste is taste, And fear not, Christopher, you are still welcome here. Jason from Hawaii retweeted last episode, All-Star Comics, with this announcement. Professor Allen dives deep into the quarter bins and finds himself in the 1970s. Check out the latest episode to find out if Professor Allen returns back to the present. Well, I returned to 1996 for this episode, so I guess we're making progress. Aloha, Jason. And on that last issue, Sir Martin of Grey mentioned that he thought that this was the first issue of this run that he ever saw. I like that DC went back to the All-Star Comics numbering and treated it as if All-Star Western hadn't previously nicked the serialized numbering. No collector's going to be confused. It was simply one run of JSA books separated by a long break. The confusion is attached to All-Star Western. I imagine people wonder, where were the first 57 issues of that? I see your point about the little figures above the unnecessary Super Squad logo being a tad cluttersome, but aren't they cute? I like the Xanadu design apart from the Carmat loincloth, and how refreshing to be reminded that Power Girl was originally not so Zoftig as she became under Wally Wood's hands. Fear not, listeners. If you don't know what Zoftig means, you can probably figure it out from context. Plus, Mart continues, two separate villain plot lines in a 17-page story? Well done, Mr. Levitz. The only real off-note for me was Hawkman's hissy fit about their having been unable to find the missing Shira Hall. I'm not sure we're even men, he proclaimed. And Superman's subsequent musing on the nature of heroism. It all felt like forced dramatics. Thank you, Sir Martin. Always appreciate your insights and your commentary. Chris Lydon thought that it was a pretty good comic to get for a quarter and a great way to begin the weekend. Now, during last episode, I talked about the concept of who the customers are and were in the 1970s for comic books, who the companies technically actually sold their product to. And longtime retail manager, Podcasting's Michael Bailey, had a few things to say about this, and we had quite a good back and forth on the topic. Professor Allen, your show is always a treat. But sometimes the episodes are sweeter than others. My love of the JSA and the All-Star Revival is on record, so it's nice to wake up and see that you are covering one of those issues on your latest episode. I enjoyed your commentary on the issue itself, but it was your lead-in to that commentary that has me writing in. I realize that the idea that I'm not the actual customer of DC Comics or Marvel or Image or Dark Horse or whoever, but rather the comic shop or distributor's the customer, is a thing, but I'll never ever agree with it. I get that publishers want to have good relationship with their sellers, and that a good bit of marketing is directed towards the seller to get them to order the product. But saying that I'm not DC's customer when I buy the comic is extremely insulting. Quick note, my ire is towards the publishers, not you, Professor. Well, that is a relief, Michael. You are the messenger here, the commentator. And if you agree with that, that's fine, because people of goodwill can disagree, but it's the system I'm mad at. Because when I walk into a Walmart, I am their customer. The way I'm treated by the staff or the condition of the store or any of the other thousand things that go on in retail is on Walmart. However, if when I'm there I buy a box of Kraft macaroni and cheese and I don't care for it, that's on Kraft, not on Walmart. In effect, when I buy something at a store, I'm the customer of both the store and the people making the product. Similarly, when I'm buying comics from a comic shop, I'm both the customer of the comic shop and the publisher. I'm choosing to buy comics from someone, but I'm also choosing to buy the comics of a particular publisher, and that publisher, not the shop, is the person to receive my praise or ire. And having that publisher look at me and say, well, Sonny, you aren't who I'm selling books to, is not only insulting, it's offensive. Again, I get that publishers have to market to the sellers and get them to order product, just as HP and Brother market to Staples to get them to carry product. But to push this narrative that I'm not DC's customers when I buy a DC comic is a way for the publisher to not have to deal with me. It's just wrongheaded. It's passing the buck. And it's a way for the publishers to not deal with people unhappy with their product. I get that historically, publishers have made decisions based on who is selling their product. But to cut me out of the equation altogether makes me wonder who they think these books ultimately end up in the hands of. Well, apparently, I have opinions on this subject. Fantastic show as always. Good luck with your grading, Michael. Yes, that was sent to me during my grading period in early December. I did find time to react to Mike, confessing, admitting, that I probably overstate the case to make the case. I talk a lot in my business classes about the producer-retailer relationship because it's a critical component to business and most people don't think about it. The point, and this is where you and I agree, Michael, is that when you're in a comic shop, you're a customer of both the LCS and the publisher. Now, the LCS ultimately determines what goes on the shelves, what is even available for you to purchase. One of the reasons the publishers like digital, that they can eliminate a step in that chain, cut one of their customers out of the loop, simplify the process. I then went on a rant about how bad much of the public is at interpreting box office results as it fits into this broad category of publisher and distributor as well. But I'll spare you that. I sent that email off to Mike, and he responded. I think this is the first business thing you've talked about that I have experience in. I think about how my job works a lot, and sometimes it makes sense, and sometimes I really want to call out the BS we're being fed by corporate. Percentage-wise, we make more profit off a 15-cent self-service copy than off selling a laptop. I will spare you the financial details that Mike went into next, but he summarized it with, the whole customer-retailer-manufacturer relationship is fascinating to me because it's one of those things that just doesn't factor into people's thinking. When I'm asked what computer is better, Lenovo or HP, I honestly tell customers, I don't have a preference because it's all pretty much the same hardware under the hood. This has led me to believe that people don't actually hate a brand, they hate the one experience they had with the brand. I hope the holidays are pleasant for you and Mrs. Quarterbin. In these trying times, we have to find the small good to deal with the huge bad. Until next time. Well, thank you, Mike. I am shocked to hear of shell games being played with accounting statements. Next, you'll be telling me that price-based podcasters sometimes fudge their numbers and apply overhead in such a way as to meet the quote-unquote rules of the podcast. Though, certainly, it is a mix in terms of people coming to your store to buy, say, HP ink. I'm sure some people come in to buy the ink and they buy from you because you've treated them well before. Here in Central Ohio, there are about 6 or 7 LCSs, and Em and I spent about a 6-month odyssey visiting them, seeing how we were treated, seeing the selection, seeing, to be honest, the presence of cheap bins before we decided on World's Greatest Comics, our LCS. So we're like that person who wants to buy a comic book and will go to our preferred store to do it. Now, I'm sure that there's some people who just swear by HP Inc. And if your store stopped supplying it, Mike, they'd go somewhere else to buy that brand. And that is why retail stores exist. They offer the convenience of having so many brands and varieties under one roof in exchange for a slightly higher price. That's the business trade-off. That's their value added to the customer. And obviously, a lot of what we've been talking about applies to the relationship between comic book companies, distributors, retailers, and us. So thank you, Mike. You know, without having in-person classroom interactions, that back and forth of a discussion. This is the best business chat I've had in ages. Thank you, Podcasting's Michael Bailey. Oh, social media love for last episode came from Pat Sampson, Vic in Phoenix, Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us, James Williams, Derek Berkey, Manuel Carmona from Truthful Comics, Randy Watts, Chris Lydon Clinton from Coffee and Comics, James Simpson, Randy Watts, Slang Word Scott, Laurel, Mountain Flower from the Hunters Podcast, Paul from the Collected Edition, Baby Skeletor, and our listeners of the year. And you have to admit, with travel shut down for 9 months, they are probably not in the international assassin business anymore. Ruth and Aaron from the Rad Adventures Network. So let's take a break here so you can forget all of that business information we went over, like my students often do. And after I play a promo, we'll come back and look at The Ray, number 20. When you think of podcasts about religion, you probably think of this.
But at least one religion podcast sounds more like this.
I kick ass for the Lord!
Dorkness to Light is a relatively geeky production in which Alan and Em discuss topics of faith, religion, and spirituality.
But we do so through the lens of pop culture, like movies, TV, and comic books, because we're nerds.
Our primary focus will be on Christianity, because that's what we know best. But all religious content is on the table.
Well, think about it, Scully, from vampirism to Catholicism.
This is an occasional cast, to be recorded and released as the mood strikes, with topics ranging from in-depth reviews to personal rants about some small aspect of theology or church history, because we're theological nerds.
If these topics interest you, check out dorknesstolight.blogspot.com for our more regular content.
Or dorknesstolight.tumblr.com for our more irregular content. Memes and puns, mostly. My bad.
Dorkness to Light.
Often irreverent, rarely sacrilegious.
The Ray, number 20, at a cover price of $2.25, meaning I got this at a nice, if you round it, 89% discount off that cover price. And it has the nice yellow 25-cent price tag stuck right onto that cover. The telltale sign that I picked this up from Half Price Books back a number of years ago, when the Half Price Book locations around here actually had quarter bins. The cover by Jason Armstrong and Andy Parks shows Ray slouching in a chair against a mostly black background, looking at a pathetic little Christmas tree straight out of Charlie Brown. The only words on the cover are "Blue Christmas." The story, The Tide, was written by Christopher Priest, with art by the cover artist team of Armstrong and Parks. We start with a kid named Joshua, about 10 years old, living in a small wooden structure in front of a frozen, snowy Christmas display. It may well be a manger. He is wishing to Santa Claus for just one thing. Daddy. Joshua had wished for his daddy, but Santa didn't come. But a couple in a VW van did come to check on Joshua. The long-haired hippie dude of the couple checks on Joshua, and they offer to help him find his dad. But before they can get too far with that, we see that Joshua is wearing a mini Impulse costume, and he zooms off into the sky. We found Super Kid. Miracles do happen on Christmas. We move to Ray Terrell's place, looking at his decorated Christmas tree. He gets a call from a cousin. I figured we'd call it a truce day. Then I thought about you working for Vandal Savage, letting that Mask of Death guy get away with icing your pops. And I thought, nah. Click. Then his boss, Vandal Savage, calls and invites Ray to a small gathering at his Crystal Palace. Just a few thousand friends. And bring the Schubert file with you. Some things in there we need to discuss. Ray muses, there's nothing quite like being alone and clueless on Christmas Day. Ray's landlord comes by to tell him that Vandal Savage has paid his rent for the next 6 months. Must be some job, kid. Ray flashes back to a recent chat with Vandal about Ray's job in computer games. Then they talk about the Justice League Task Force. Last issue, he walked out on them, and Savage tells him he's useless in his current distracted space. Ray, you're their family, and they need you. Out of the flashback, he decides to help the task force and flies out that way. Back in Colorado, the hippie couple have gotten info from the kid that he is Joshua Terrell, son of Happy Terrell. Ray finds an old senator in Washington, but he looks really young. He actually looks a lot like Black Condor. And he tells Ray that he and a few others sit atop the world, nudging it where it needs to go. And he tells Ray they need a new champion. And since the new Black Condor didn't work out for that gig, maybe Ray is their man. Ray zooms out to Pine Barrens in New Jersey to find Black Condor, just to see what this is all about. But Condor really, I mean, like really, wants to be left alone. Joshua Terrell is returned to a nearby Mrs. Terrell, who is not Joshua's mother, but those details seem quite complicated, actually. She mentions that Happy has been missing for a while, but he's had his shadow keeping an eye on me. Some guy named Ray. Ray takes off for his last appointment of Christmas Day, more like Christmas evening, maybe Christmas night, to be honest. And he meets a woman named Jazz, who lets him know just how late he is. She asks if Ray is as big a jerk as his cousin is. You know, the guy who dumped me at the chicken shack in the middle of the night. Ray tells her he's not his cousin, and that he has had a pretty crazy Christmas day. So I guess it's your move. And then on the last page, Jazz gives Ray a big old Christmas smoochin'. The end. Okay, I'm not gonna lie. I bought this comic in the early days of the Quarterman podcast because I thought it would be cool to have some holiday-themed selections in the database. I didn't buy it because I'm a huge fan of the Ray, loved the Ray, was dying to talk about the Ray. Because no, not one bit. Here, at the end of 2020, looks like I'm on pace to read nearly 2,000 comics, at least 1,900. In the last 6 years, as long as I've been keeping track of comics that I've read, that totals about 7,500 or so. I don't say that to brag about how few friends I have or how pathetically small my life has become over the years. Hey, wait a minute. It's just to say that I read a pretty good amount of comics. And over that time, DC has been the single publisher that I've read the most issues from. And despite all of that, after reading this one issue of The Ray, in total, I have now read one issue of The Ray. Like I've said many times, I was out of comics during the 90s, especially the mid to late 90s. So many things went right over my head, including The Ray and, mercifully, Justice League Task Force. So it's possible I didn't know much or anything that was happening here. And just to fill in anyone else like myself who is a little lacking in Ray knowledge, let me bring you and myself up to speed. This version of The Ray appeared 4 years before this in a miniseries created by Jack C. Harris and Joe Quesada. Now, the original Ray was Langford Happy Terrell, a quality comics character adopted into the Freedom Fighters during their 1970s run, the 15-issue run, which was after DC purchased the quality characters. Now, cards on the table. This may partially explain my anti-Ray position. Man, I love the Freedom Fighters. I had all 15 of those issues, and I read them over and over, and I'd say over. So this might be a case of not my Ray. My Ray is Happy Terrell, and he was part of the Freedom Fighters, not Ray. I completely admit that. But that having been said, let me give a little history about the legacy character, this version of the Ray. And some of this is touched on in the issue. At the age of 18, Ray Terrell learns the truth about his heritage while at the deathbed of his father, Happy. The dying man admits that he was the Golden Age Ray, and that exposure to sunlight will activate Raymond's own light-based superpowers. You see, as a child, he would have been unable to control such power, and thus had to be kept in darkness. At the funeral for Happy, Ray meets his cousin Hank, who urges him to become a superhero like his father. Raymond eventually decides to take up the mantle of the Ray. In terms of comic book history, after the 6-issue mini, this series came along in 1994 and ran for 28 issues. There was a 4-issue series in 2012 titled The Ray that featured a different character in the title role. He did eventually join the Justice League, as well as the Forgotten Heroes and Young Justice. And he's appeared on TV as part of the Crisis on Infinite Earths CW crossover, and in a few episodes of shows before that. I am sure that I'm missing a lot of info about The Ray, but I'm going to be honest, I've yet to find a comic database that is anywhere close to being as good as the late lamented comic book DB was for gathering the type of information that I was looking for regarding the Ray. Also, did want to talk for a second about the title of this story, Blue Christmas. Not only is that a song by Elvis, it's also a type of actual service that many churches have developed over the last decade or so. It's designed to be an alternative to the loud and boisterous Christmas celebrations, a smaller and quieter, more subdued, more contemplative service to minister to those who are discouraged or depressed or grieving, or for whatever reason, may not be in the mood for a colorful and loud Christmas celebration. And not meaning to plug too crassly, but Em and I have done Blue Christmas episodes of Darkness to Light, both in 2019 and 2020. If you're listening to this in the first few days of its availability, the 2020 Darkness to Light episode may not be out just yet. Now, on this particular issue, like I hinted at, there was a lot of stuff I just didn't get. And I readily admit that is because you're not supposed to start following a comic at issue 20. Clearly, a lot of stuff had gone on before this, and even though a few of those things were explained, not everything was. Like, who was that kid? There were bits of dialogue that led me to think maybe he wasn't actually a kid. Again, if I'd known the background of the series, that is something I'm sure I would have known. Same with Black Condor and that senator guy who may have also been a prior Black Condor. Now, I don't believe it's a comic book's responsibility to hold my hand and take panel space and page real estate to bring me up to speed, if that's not what the creators want to do. But this, The Ray number 20, is very far away from the old Marvel idea, I guess Stan Lee's concept of every comic book, perhaps being someone's first comic book. Now, at this point with issue 20, the comic was not exactly burning up the sales charts. According to the excellent Comicron.com website, this specific issue landed around 130 on the sales chart. The end may very well have been in sight, for all I know, in terms of a looming cancellation. Or even if it hadn't gotten that far officially, the creators could certainly see the writing on the walls at this point. I'm sure they knew the comic wasn't long for the world. And they probably knew they had a small but loyal fan base. And maybe that's why they didn't see the need to handhold new readers and just wanted the page space to tell their story, the whole story, and nothing but the story. They probably weren't expecting to get new readers at this stage. So why write the comic to be friendly to potential new readers? I have no idea about any of that. Those are all just wild, hypothetical speculations. But the fact of that style of storytelling is going to have to directly affect my verdict on this comic. The verdict on The Rain number 20. There were a few bits of this that were okay to good, but so much of this just didn't work as a single issue. I'm sure the subplots and references and flashbacks were meaningful to faithful readers of the book. Obviously, Christopher Priest, a solid comic book professional, but as a one-off story reading it without any context, it wasn't that great. We always say the goal of a comic book, the ultimate determinant of success in a comic, is whether it makes you want to read another issue. And let me say this, I don't think I'm going to be grabbing any more issues of The Ray out of any bins, be they dollar, 50 cent, three for a buck, quarter, or even our annual LCS's dime sale. I'm just going to keep leaving copies of The Ray behind in every bin where I see them. And that means, and I don't know when the last time this happened was, I know it has been a long while, and it only happens rarely. But no, this issue was not worth a quarter. And that wraps up my coverage of The Ray number 20, bringing episode 162 to a close. Next time, we're going big. We're going mega, as a matter of fact. With Spider-Man Magazine number 1 from Marvel Comics, cover dated October 1994. If you have any questions or comments about this issue or the episode, The Ray, Christmas stories, or the podcast in general, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the quarter bin. And God bless us, everyone. The Quarter Bin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Short Box Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening. Mary wakes a little piece of me every time she sings a verse of Mary's song. Razor sharp thorns on rose bushes in the garden by the gates of Mary's home. Mary dreams of fallen empires, begging kings while homeless men sit on the throne. The kicking, crying boy inside
does it mean to be the favored one? What does it mean that God is with you? God is with you. God is with me
too. Music in this episode is by the band So Elated from their Christmas album, The Bewildering Light.
Mary bites her lip and takes a breath, nods her head and says, "Let it be done." Just behind this thick-skinned warrior lies a girl who understands the days to come. Inside our hearts, we've known it all. Deep inside your heart, you know.